The circumstances of your birth don't define you or your potential. I think that's a life lesson we can learn from the subject of this week's podcast, Leonardo da Vinci. He was a bastard, the illegitimate child of a notary, and perhaps one of the most intelligent, insightful, and talented people that the world has ever seen. Compared to some of his contemporaries, examples of his work is rather limited, as his perfectionism diminished the amount of paintings he completed. But the breadth of his notes and drawings shows a depth of knowledge that I truly believe comes only once in several centuries. In order to cover the lifetime of Leonardo da Vinci, we'll discuss his early life, his training as an apprentice and later a master, and the legacy he's left to the world. Welcome to History with Brittany, the podcast that explores all things history. Each Wednesday, we'll discuss a historical topic, person, or event, and how it has impacted our world today. So without further ado, let's get started. Leonardo da Vinci was born on April 15, 1452, in Ancino, Italy, which is west of Florence. His father, Piero da Vinci, was part of a family of notaries, and his mother was an orphaned peasant named Caterina. During that time, being a notary was actually a rather noble and prestigious profession, so much so that it was actually quite advantageous for Leonardo to be born as a bastard or illegitimate child. During this period of history, notaries in Italy were especially well known for supporting the rising mercantile class in order to process all the business happening in Italy and the rest of the quote-unquote world at the time. Notaries were crucial as they drew up commercial contracts, land sales, wills, and other legal documents, which were actually all written down in Latin. Since his father was a notary, if Leonardo had been born within a marriage, he would have been expected to become a notary like his father as the firstborn son. Due to his status, though, he was able to pursue his passion for art. We unfortunately don't know much about his mother, except that her story is rather tragic. Having been orphaned at the age of 14, she took care of her brother and eventually became involved with Piero. Due to the difference in their social classes, there would be no marriage, and Piero was actually betrothed to someone else. After Leonardo's birth, Piero actually arranged a marriage between Caterina and a local farmer and kiln worker. For those of us in the 21st century, this might sound strange, but believe it or not, being born as an illegitimate child was not a big deal in Italy at the time. Historian Jacob Burckhardt actually calls this the quote-unquote golden age for bastards. Leonardo was actually publicly baptized within the community and had 10 godparents, including sharing one with his father. This shows acceptance for Leonardo's role in Piero's life. The relationship between Caterina and Piero was actually quite friendly, and Leonardo spent much of his childhood bouncing between two homes, which I think nowadays would not be considered all that unusual. Leonardo also remained Piero's heir for the first 24 years of his life, because his father's first and second marriage produced no children. But this status gave Leonardo a unique advantage. He didn't attend a Latin school and was not formally educated except for an abacus school, which somebody would maybe go to and learn if they were interested in getting into a trade. Though he was rather embarrassed by his lack of formal education, it could be said that encouraged his creativity and interest in observation and experimentation. Instead of learning in a formal school, he made the entire world his classroom, asking questions and discovering the answers for himself. This insatiable curiosity and freedom from the legacy of his family would drive his quest for knowledge throughout the rest of his life. A little sidebar here, I'm definitely not encouraging anyone to skip out on schooling, but there are some things that can only be learned by asking questions and searching for the answers yourself. In many ways, he was brought up during the perfect time to push the boundaries of knowledge. It was the Renaissance, when interactions with the Ottoman Empire brought forth ancient works from great Greek and Roman philosophers that had been lost for centuries to the Europeans. This led to a revived interest in these ancient texts. It was also a great time for art, of which Leonardo would become one of its greatest contributors. At the age of 12, Leonardo's father did something that would change his life forever. He went to Florence. In the 1400s, Florence was the epicenter of the Renaissance. Ruled by the famous Medici family, Florence was one of the world's premier patrons of arts and craftsmen. It was also a great banking city-state, which helped it become one of the wealthiest in Italy. At the time, Italy was not a united country, believe it or not. Florence was actually basically its own city-state with a republic form of government ruled over by the Medici family, who owned one of the most prosperous prosperous banks in Europe at the time. The Medicis were known to have produced four popes and were the patrons of both Leonardo and Niccolo Machiavelli.
Yes, that Machiavelli.
And both of them eventually became travel partners with a relation of the Pope, Cesare Borgia, who deeply influenced Machiavelli's The Prince. The Medici family also helped finance Michelangelo and Galileo. And they're also responsible for financing the creation of the piano and opera. To say this family was wealthy and connected is a vast understatement. By the time Leonardo's father, Piero, took his young son to the city, he knew the likelihood of Leonardo taking up the family tradition was slim to none. According to Vasari, one of Leonardo's earliest biographers, who did tend to lie and fudge the truth a bit here and there, he, quote, never ceased drawing and sculpting, pursuits which suited his fancy more than any other, unquote. Piero was eventually able to secure Leonardo an apprenticeship with Andrea del Verrocchi, who was a painter and engineer and ran one of the best shops in the city. As an apprentice, Leonardo lived with Verrocchi and other apprentices, as was tradition. Though the arts were considered a lesser status, that was beginning to change at the time. The influence of ancient Roman works was encouraging an explosion in artwork. Verrocchi is most well known for a small statue of King David standing over the head of Goliath, which some think that Leonardo actually modeled for. Many who knew Leonardo reported that he was quite beautiful, I think in their definition, and handsome in ours. His contemporary biographer wrote that the young painter had, quote, a beauty of body beyond description, a splendor that rejoiced the most sorrowful souls, unquote. I think that if anyone said that today, we would look at them and think they're a bit crazy. But beyond his obvious talent, Leonardo was apparently quite a looker. In that sculpture, Verrocchi showed his talent for anatomical accuracy, a talent and skill that Leonardo would eventually learn and by far surpass. For example, in the statue, the veins of David's arms actually pop at the exact right spot, demonstrating that the young future king was holding the sword tightly. Not all artists had or were invested in developing this talent. Verrocchi also designed the geometric design for Cosimo del Medici's tomb, which deeply influenced Leonardo and the eventual creation of the Vitruvian Man. He also learned how to drape and painting and a lot of other skills before finally finishing his program. As a young man, Leonardo eventually graduated from being an apprentice to a master painter, though he decided initially to remain at Verrocchi's studio, where he contributed to several works of art while still sketching his own works. In the Renaissance, that would happen quite frequently. While the master laid the foundation and most of the outline for the artwork, the apprentices or other artists within the shop would apparently also contribute to perhaps a particular person or a particular animal in the piece. When Leonardo started completing his own paintings, he did not follow the same tradition, as he was far too much of a perfectionist to let anyone else touch or contribute to his work. While he remained at Verrocchi's shop, he created four notable paintings, the Annunciation, Madonna of the Carnation, Madonna and the Child with Flowers, and the Portrait of Ginevra de' Benci. The Annunciation painting is contested as Leonardo's work because some consider it rather sloppy compared to what we see later. The two Madonna paintings are good, but nothing compared to his later work and similar subject matter. He actually did the Madonna quite a few times. The Portrait of Bendici, a commission probably arranged for Leonardo by his father, is probably the best reflection of the heights that his works would reach during this early time. It compares slightly to Leonardo's most infamous painting, the Mona Lisa. It was around this time, a week before his 24th birthday, that Leonardo was arrested for engaging in sodomy with a male prostitute. These charges were anonymous and leveled against several young men, but since no one could corroborate it, Leonardo was released. He was arrested again later for supposedly engaging in several sexual interactions with the same prostitute, but those charges were also dropped. If convicted, Leonardo could have been sentenced to prison, exile, or even death. Sodomy and homosexuality were considered a sin by the church at the time. Right now, that question, based on the scandals of the Catholic Church in Europe, are entirely debatable. Homosexuality in Florence wasn't unusual at the time. In fact, slang for homosexual activity during the time was sometimes called, quote-unquote, the Italian vice, named for that particular reason. The Germans also used the term Florencer, which was slang for homosexuality. Leonardo never married throughout his life, nor did he have any close relations with a woman, but he did keep close male companions, which were usually young, attractive men. One in particular was Salai, who traveled with Leonardo for many years and also took advantage of his patron many times. I think Leonardo called him the little devil.
It's likely, based on most of this evidence, that Leonardo did not find women attractive and likely engaged in homosexual activity, though we have no direct evidence of that. In fact, he wrote, quote, "The sexual act of coitus and the body parts employed for it are so repulsive, if it were not for the beauty of the faces and the adornment of the actors and the pent-up impulse, nature would lose the human species." You know, take that quote for what you will. It was perhaps due to this change that Leonardo finally had the courage to leave Verrucci's workshop and set up his own shop, which begins one of the key problems throughout his entire career, his inability to complete many works. During this time, he actually started a painting known as the Adoration of the Magi, which quickly became behind schedule and was never completed. The church that commissioned the painting eventually went in different directions due to Leonardo's inability to give them a finished piece of artwork in the time allotted. Leonardo was a perfectionist, so there were actually several pieces of artwork that were never completed, and others that he kept with him throughout his entire life so he can continue to work and adjust them. The Mona Lisa was one of those paintings. Leonardo eventually came into the employ of the Duke of Milan, well, Ludovico Sforza, to be exact. He wasn't actually the Duke of Milan, but was ruling the city-state at the time. The Sforzas are another one of those infamous and warring Italian families. It was during his time in the city that Leonardo worked on some of the paintings that made him an artist of an unparalleled brilliance that we consider him today. It was during this time, later in his career, when he had achieved some prominence that he drew the Vertuian Man, which was a bit of a craze at the time. The Vertuian Man was named after Marcus Vertuius Pollio, a Roman soldier who served under Julius Caesar. He, in addition to being a military man, was an architect who posited, among many other ancients, including Plato, of the relationship between the microcosm of man and the microcosm of earth. Because of this, Pollio argued that buildings should be laid out in similar proportions to the human body. He wrote, quote, "There must be a precise relation between its components, as in the case of those of a well-shaped man," unquote. The premise was basically to square a circle, to make the area of a circle and a square equal, and put the man in the center of the circle and the square, with his arms extended and his legs in two different positions. This would represent the perfectly constructed temple and a man's portions as well. It was a bit strange, but hey, it was a thing at the time. Though the drawing of this Vertuian Man had become something that every artist was trying, Leonardo's sketch was the ultimate perfection of the technique, because in part, you actually can't circle a square. The sketch is currently in Venice, under lockdown at the Galleria dell'Accademia. It's extremely delicate and cannot be exposed for long periods of time for fear of actually diminishing the strength of the ink. His ability to sketch such an impressive work is due to the fact that Leonardo, in addition to his work as a painter and sculptor and set designer, believe it or not, was also highly interested in anatomy, which was a bit unusual at the time. Getting a cadaver and performing an autopsy would be considered distasteful, but Leonardo was a master at taking measurements and mapping out nearly every aspect of the human body. Per Vertuius's original manuscript, the center of the circle should be the man's belly button, and the center of the square should be his genitals. Leonardo was easily able to accomplish this feat, and his sketch is by far the superior. In Milan, Leonardo also created his two Virgin on the Rocks paintings, perhaps made most famous by their use in the runaway hit The Da Vinci Code, which was wrong. The paintings are different and yet similar. The most notable difference is the decision to have the angel pointing at St. John or John the Baptist in the first and removing the pointing finger in the second. The complex studies have shown that Leonardo debated the pointing finger numerous times before finally settling in and keeping it. Whether that was by design or at the insistence of the patron is unknown. These paintings also show Leonardo's understanding of nature and plant life. In his first version, now housed at the Louvre, the background garden is actually botanically correct, utilizing the right plants for the right season. The second version is incredibly similar to the first, though not as precise when it comes to the nature elements. This leads some to believe that a considerable or some portions of the painting were actually done by members of Leonardo's shop, but that conclusion has actually been challenged, and now scholars believe that was mostly painted by the master himself, which makes sense. As a true perfectionist, he would never let somebody else touch his work so heavily. Even if Leonardo did have students, I don't think they did very much. Of course, his most infamous painting that resides in Milan today is The Last Supper, which along with the Mona Lisa are his two greatest creations. Again, it took him some considerable time to complete it, more than the other. others, commissioned by Ludovico Sforza to reside in the Santa Maria del Grazie Church and Monastery, it is a master class in capturing motion. As Leonardo's most recent biographer, Walter Isaacson, says, quote, "The Last Supper's artificial staging, exaggerated motions, tricks of perspective, and theatricality of the hand gestures demonstrates the influence of Leonardo's work as a court impresario and producer," unquote. The Last Supper is about a moment in time where Christ tells his disciples that someone will betray him. It's all about movement and emotion, and it's also about perspective. Leonardo knew that a painting as big as The Last Supper, I think probably the largest he produced in his career, would be seen from multiple different perspectives. Leonardo tried to account for all of those in his painting. It was painted with oil, which Leonardo favored because it allowed him to go back multiple times and change things and adjust things very subtly. But it also meant that the painting remains incredibly fragile and damaged today. In fact, just 20 or so years after its completion, due to the process that Leonardo used, which was incomplete at the time, the paint was actually already beginning to flake and eventually started to fade as well. The monks even decide to make a door at the bottom of the painting, which cut off Jesus's feet. There's not much left of the original today. Successive preservation attempts going back hundreds of years have mostly been failures. If you see them painting today in Milan, which I got to do in 2007, the room is actually quite dark and cold. Those temperature control measures allow the preservationists to try to retain what little of the paint remains today. If you visit Milan, it's definitely worth the time to visit. In fact, it was the only thing we did in Milan. But when it comes to paintings, none really compares to the Mona Lisa, which in many ways was his magnum opus. According to the Louvre's website, there's a fair amount we don't know about the Mona Lisa. We don't know who commissioned it, who's sitting for the portrait, how long he was actually working on the piece. We do know that it traveled with Leonardo and was actually in his possession when he died. It is likely that the painting is actually of Lisa del Giocondo, a woman born within a minority branch of the Geraldini family, and she eventually married Francisco del Giocondo. It's likely that Leonardo, if indeed Lisa is a subject of the painting, got the commission through his father's connections. But Lisa likely never saw the final product, though. And ironically, she is perhaps one of the most famous faces in all the world. The painting was a culmination of Leonardo's skills with light, shadow, shades, and optics. One of those optical illusions is the dilation of her pupils, which are actually different. Leonardo erroneously believed that light causes pupils to dilate differently. That's not actually the case, but some believe that it gives the audience a sense that she is happy to see us, with one eye recognizing the guest faster than the other. The eyes also appear to follow you throughout the room. Another effect that Leonardo didn't invent, but did perfect. Again, Leonardo always gave his paintings a sense of movement. The draping on her dress also reflects this. He also gave her a slight veil that you can see on her forehead. It's so faint, actually, that if it were not for the line on top of her head, you probably wouldn't even know it existed. But most importantly, perhaps, is her smile, which is both enigmatic and utterly iconic. By this time, Leonardo has spent much of his spare energies conducting autopsies on individuals in order to discover and increase his knowledge of anatomy for his paintings. One thing he discovered is that it is impossible to pucker the upper lip by itself. The muscle is connected to the lower, but it is possible to purse the lower, but not the upper lip. Go ahead, try it. To discover something this simple is probably not mind-blowing, but it deeply impacted his work as an artist. I am not a fan of modern art, I will say. It can be something as ridiculous as a golden toilet, or a splatter paint art, which could be done by an adult, a child, or even a dog. It's not, and it leaves much to be desired when compared to the utter brilliance of Leonardo's and much of his contemporaries. It just seems both distasteful and just utterly bad and lacking in talent. Unfortunately, like The Last Supper, time has not been kind to the Mona Lisa. Layers of varnish applied to the top have yellowed the artwork, giving it that distinctive look we know today. I've had the opportunity to see the Mona Lisa three times. It's in a large room in the Louvre, with a plexiglass covering that I believe is actually bulletproof, and there's always layers and layers of tourists surrounding it. It's actually a rather small piece of art, believe it or not. So honestly, it's not my favorite of his, and actually doesn't do much for me. Never really did, but I can appreciate the technical expertise that went into creating it. Towards the end of his life, after living mostly in Milan and Florence, Leonardo spent his last days in France as a patron of Francis I. His effects and paintings, including the Mona Lisa, were divided among family members and close associates. It was this connection with France that helped several of Leonardo's works eventually make it into the Louvre today. Throughout his life, Leonardo created only a handful of works, really. A little over two dozen can be claimed as his today. and some of those he didn't even finish. But his legacy remains, and he has influenced inventors and great thinkers for centuries. Though we mostly know him as a painter, Leonardo was many other things as well. He tackled mathematics and war machinery, city planning, and traveled around with the likes of Machiavelli and Cesare Borgia. He was always looking to the future, sketching things as complex and technologically advanced as bombs and even a helicopter. His drawings of anatomy are so utterly brilliant and precise that they're comparable to an MRI or CAT scan today. He even spent a lot of time in nature, thinking about the movement of water, plants, and rock formations. There's the genius. And then there was just the one man or woman who is born into the world every couple hundred of years. Leonardo is one of those men. His curiosity and understanding of nature was profound for a man of his time period. He is actually one of the first people to give humanity an inside glimpse into the womb, something that can't really be replicated without an ultrasound today. He is, in the absolute sense of the word, a one-of-a-kind genius. His brilliance has inspired many others as well. Bill Gates, the founder of Microsoft, actually purchased some of his notes for his private collection. Steve Jobs, the founder of Apple, was also deeply inspired by the life of Leonardo. But one of the greatest lessons I think we can learn from him is that your birth does not define your life. Leonardo, though well-loved in his family, was an illegitimate child. In another time, he might have been cast aside for a situation he had no control of, or maybe even aborted. Can you imagine not having the Mona Lisa or the Last Supper for something as simple as legitimacy? He was blessed to be raised in a time when being a bastard was both accepted and rather common, but was a struggle for him to feel like he didn't fit in and that he didn't have the same life as his half-siblings. But at the end of the day, life is what we make of it. Leonardo took his intellect and his curiosity and created some of the greatest works of art humanity has ever known. And that is history. Thank you all so much for listening. If you want to learn more about Leonardo, then I highly recommend Walter Isaacson's biography, which I think is rather excellent. Anyways, as always, drop me a line on social media at History with Brittany or visit historywithbrittany.com. I would love to hear from you. And please subscribe. Have a great week.